welcome. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show today on WEAA. And why are we playing Please, Mr. Postman by the Marvelettes? Well, let's take a look at this day in history, which is this day in history and what happened on this August 21st in our history. Well, in 1961, Motown released its first big hit, the Marvelettes, Please, Mr. Postman. And we might play a remix of that later in the program. For our younger listeners out there who like to hear a remix as opposed to the old man's music that I like. But we'll play it all here on the Mark Steiner Show today. But that happened on this day in history. Also on this day in history, who was born on this day? Aubrey Beardsley, a really amazing illustrator and author in history, a British author, was born in 1872. This is the day that Count Basie was born. One of the great band leaders. Count Basie Orchestra, just one of the classic major influences on modern jazz. We'll play some Count Basie in the course of the next couple hours so you can hear a bit of him since we're honoring his day. This is the day in 1932 that the American filmmaker and actor and screenwriter and general overall madman and brilliant madcap genius Melvin Van Peebles was born on this day in 1932. Will Chamberlain was born on this day in 1936, one of America's great basketball players, records unbroken still. Peter Weir, the Australian film director. This is the day in 1940 that I said yesterday, Leon Trotsky, who was the socialist revolutionary from Russia, was murdered by Stalin's henchmen and thugs in Mexico, and it was hit in the head with an axe yesterday on this day in history. Today he died on this day in history. A great book, a novel called Lacuna, if you want to read it, get a sense of that piece of history, that's the book to read, by Barbara Kingsolver. Amazing novel that really kind of puts you in that moment. This is a day in 1971. I was there for this day. We were all standing outside the prison. This is the day that George Jackson, co-founder of the Black Guerrilla Family, then a real radical revolutionary organization, not just a gang, was killed in the prison in San Francisco at Soledad, where he was one of the Soledad brothers who wrote the book, The Soledad Brothers, and was a centerpiece of a lot of movements to change the prison system. He was killed on this day. This is the day in 1981 that Michael Devine died. He was the first Irish hunger striker, a member of the Irish Republican Army, to die in a British prison. Refusing to eat until Northern Ireland was liberated from British control. He died on this day in 1981. This day in 1680, Pueblo Indians captured Santa Fe. They thought a peaceful tribe that decided they didn't want the Spaniards taking their land. They actually fought back on this day. And this is a day also in 1831, a major piece of American history. This is the day that Nat Turner's rebellion began. He had a vision that God told him to stand up to the oppressors and to fight for the freedom of African Americans who were being held as slaves in Virginia. It was a bloody revolt. 55 folks were killed by Nat Turner's guerrillas, but hundreds of African Americans were killed later by militias. It began the beginning of when they captured Nat Turner. It was the beginning. He was flayed, quartered, and hung. It was the beginning of many of the laws that took place that denied slaves in Virginia and places the right to learn how to read, to pray by themselves, and more. A lot of repression came down after that for the next 35 years until slavery was ended. The state executed 666 black people on plantations immediately after this happened. And it was a day that really some people argue, and I know that there are people who are trying to make a movie in Nat Turner's life, but they were told by one major production company, we'll never make a movie that doesn't appeal to white people in America. So no matter what it says, so that says a great deal about that. And so it was on this day that the revolt started with Nat Turner. This was a day in history that the first adding machine was patented by William Seward Burroughs in the year 1898. That's where all the troubles began in terms of our digitization of society, and look where we are today. And this is in 1893, the first Occupy Wall Street. Emma Goldman, who was a revolutionary leader in the 1890s and the early 1900s, led a march of 1,000 people to Union Square on this day in 1893. Shortly after the panic, like we had here, of 1893, they closed 600 banks, bankruptcy for railroads, 15,000 other firms fell under. She told the people, go into the streets where the rich dwell. Ask for work. If they do not give you work, ask for bread. If they don't give you work or bread, then take the bread. And 10 days later, she was arrested for those statements, given a year in prison, where she studied. And when she came out of prison a year later, she was met by a crowd of almost 3,000 people. She said she was imprisoned for talking and would soon be talking again, were her words. This is the day in 1943 that Harriet M. West was the first black woman major in the Women's Army Corps. And this was also the day when, during the Vietnam War in 1963, for those of you who weren't there, that the Army of the Republic of South Vietnam Special Forces killed hundreds, thousands, hundreds of people by attacking Buddhist pagodas because they opposed the war in Vietnam and arresting thousands. This is also the day that James Anderson Jr. was awarded the first Medal of Honor awarded to an African-American U.S. Marine posthumously here in this country. So that's this day in history, August the 21st. And now we jump into our living day in history, and we're going to look at what the state of our cities are in America today. And we, as we thought about this show, we were thinking about what's going on in places like Richmond, California. And let me just throw out some of the reality of what's happening in places like Richmond, California, what's happening in Detroit and here in Baltimore, then we'll weigh into our conversation with our guests who I'm about to introduce. So Richmond, California is a city in California in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's a working-class city. In the Bay Area. What the mayor and the city council did was to say that they used the powers of eminent domain, a power provided under the Fifth Amendment, they say, to take private land and use it for public purpose. Let's say, for example, you had a $200,000 mortgage, and now your house is worth $100,000. But the city of Richmond said, okay, in order to save these houses and keep the tax base, we're using eminent domain. And when your property is taken, reimbursements have to be paid at market value according to the Constitution. So they are taking these homes, offering $100,000, $20,000 less costs and fees, giving that $80,000 to the bank. The bank then has to eat the $120,000, but tax codes and federal banking programs protect them so they don't lose the money. And what the bank really loses is the profit that it would have made if it continued to hold that mortgage. Then the city goes back to the homeowner and says, we're giving you this new mortgage. Of your debt has gone from $200,000 to $100,000, and they renegotiate the mortgage for the homeowner. Two major banks, Wells Fargo and Deutsche Bank, and the Federal Reserve, by the way, are taking Richmond to court to stop them and other cities in California from instituting this program. If they win this case, it could change the nature of what cities can do in the nature of housing and mortgage and more. This is a huge case. And we're talking about its effect. We're also going to talk about Detroit. We know what's happening in Detroit. There's a big battle over pensions. And even the New York Times, which often sides with Wall Street in their editorials, in this particular case, what they wrote was that they're saying the bank's 25% hit is nothing compared with Detroit's suggested 90% cut to pensions unfunded liability. There's debate now whether that pension is unfunded or not between those who hold the mortgages and the people who are running the city for the state of Michigan. And this is also a time to think about, you know, people, some argue, and the New York Times and other places have argued, that municipal officials are the prey of Wall Street, that the Dodd-Franklin financial reform called on regulators to establish enhanced protection for municipalities. But that has not been enforced nor pushed by Securities and Exchange Commission, which has yet to figure out how to set up the rules. And the Commodity Futures Trading Commission rules are so weak, they cannot stop the banks from doing what they want to do to municipalities. That's part of this discussion. So the question people have is, should banks have special treatment given what's happening around in our cities? And finally, in Baltimore, Maryland, the ongoing debate that'll be solved today because the folks who have Harbor Point will get what they want from the city council today. But the ongoing debate is, what is proper development in the city? Who makes those decisions? Is it and in whose interest are those decisions being made? So, and we did have our guest here today. Dr. Steve Isberg is back with us, Associate Professor of Finance at the University of Baltimore Merritt School of Business. Jeff Singer, founder and former Executive Director of Healthcare for the Homeless. Dr. Lester Spence, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University, Center for Emerging Media Scholar in Residence, Detroit native, and co-producing a series we'll be beginning soon called Baltimore, Detroit, Oakland, looking at those three cities. And gentlemen, welcome. Good to have you all in the studio.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
And let me just say that we did ask the American Bankers Association and other financial institutions to join us. Nobody was available to come in to kind of argue that side of the case. So that's the only reason that we have people with three different ideas here, but none representing the interests of the banks and the financial institutions. I just want to say that's why we did attempt to get people in. They said that maybe we'll come next time. We'll see, because there will be a next time. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages or tweet us at Mark Steiner. I see some questions coming in for the next hour, but if you have questions this hour, 410-319-8888 and comments. So what's your comment on this overall overarching picture? Let's look at the overarching picture first and what it says to us all. Let's begin with our phone guest. Today he's by phone because he's out of town, Dr. Lester Spence.
Hey, one of the things that I think what's really, really important and one of the reasons why we're doing the Cities Project is because cities, particularly Rust Belt cities, but cities in general, are increasingly being disciplined in such a way that prevents them from giving valuable services to their citizens, to all of them, particularly to their middle class, their working class, and their poor citizens, right? And this disciplining process forces cities and city officials to be increasingly entrepreneurial, to look for a downtown development as opposed to neighborhood development, for that makes them look to giving tax breaks to businesses, to giving corporate welfare to businesses as opposed to giving welfare to regular folk. And all the cases we're talking about today are somehow wrestling with this. And in the case of Richmond, we actually see, for the first time, you very rarely see this, we actually see political officials actually attempting to do something in favor of the little people, so to speak, as opposed to corporate actors.
Steve Isberg.
I think what's interesting, the common thread between these cases is that we're looking at what amounts to a 60-some-odd year trend now, beginning in the 1950s, that's affected the cities. And, you know, there's been a lot of exit of the tax base. There's been exit of middle-income residents from the cities. And over that time period, the need for cities to provide services has continued to grow because a lot of the business has stayed in the city, you know, the office towers. You have people who used to live and work in the city, now still work in the city, but they come in from somewhere else, putting a drain on a lot of the services that need to be provided, a drain on the infrastructure, creating a cost for the city. And that added on top of the cost of providing its services to its residents and the effect of the depleting tax base, the residential tax base has been depleting, has created some significant financial problems, and we're starting to see some of those come to a head, especially in Detroit. And the Baltimore case is another example of, you know, what do we do now to solve that revenue problem? And where is there going to be an opportunity for us to properly fund the services that are needed, and not only for, you know, the businesses that are locating in the city, but for the residents that live there that don't necessarily work in some of those businesses?
Jeff Singer, your overarching analysis, and we'll dive into these questions.
That was a keen observation, but I do want to point out that it's not just the market, the free hand of the market, that created this disparity. Now, it's conscious social policies for at least the last 60 years. And the result of it is that cities are now poor, entering increasingly into bankruptcy. Chapter 9 bankruptcy now has befallen Center Falls, Rhode Island, and Vallejo, California, and Harrisonburg, Pennsylvania, and Jefferson County, Alabama, where Birmingham is. These cities are now in Chapter 9 bankruptcy. Again, it's not a new policy. It's not a new phenomena. New York City was bankrupt in 1975, and in fact, a Supreme Court judge there signed the bankruptcy papers but never filed them because they figured out a way out of that. In 1994, Orange County went into bankruptcy, and they owed several billion dollars because of bad bets on interest rates. But the social policies we're talking about include subsidizing people to move to suburbs with the interstate highway system in the 50s, with low mortgage interest rates for homeowners buying properties in the suburbs primarily, the VA loans that happened after World War II, and the FHA loans, and then other kinds of subsidies that have depleted the tax base in the city. So these are complicated and complex issues, but they're also, we can solve them. We just have to work together to do that.
We can solve them. Let's talk about can we solve them. We can solve them. Let me come back to we can solve them in a moment. I want to ask this question. Your sense, all of you, of what Richmond, California is doing. This is a huge precedent. I mean, this is happening in five other cities. One, West Las Vegas, Nevada, and three other smaller cities in California are also doing the same thing that Richmond's doing. But this really is a challenge to the banking system, as I call it, the Clintonian deregulated banking system, because it all occurred under Bill Clinton when these deregulations took place, allowing banks to do the kind of things they're doing today. And some people would argue, and I'm making a pejorative statement here, allowed banks to kind of prey on cities and municipalities because they had the wherewithal to do it. So this is kind of a hit back at that. What would it mean for cities like Baltimore and Detroit and other cities if they did the same thing? And what this would cause to have cities actually taking over mortgages and force them down to what market rates are today. Let's talk about what this strategy means, what it means for cities, what it means for families.
Well, Mark, in all fairness to Bill Clinton, it didn't start with him.
No, it did not start with him.
It goes back to the 1980s when they started
to deregulate.
It did not start with
him, but he was a pinnacle of it, what happened
was
under.
It reached its summit with him.
Right.
And the question is, you know, was he doing just what had to be done at that point? It goes back to the beginning of the dismantling of the 1930s banking regulations, which really started in the 1980s. That aside, your point is I think correct and well taken. You know, in regard to what Richmond is doing, when you consider the fact that the federal government has stepped in on behalf of the taxpayers and offered the banking industry what probably amounts to about a $5 trillion bailout of its mistakes, it's about time that someone is stepping up for the smaller, lower, middle-income individual who got caught up in that maelstrom. Who many of whom did what appeared to be the right thing to do at the time, and very often were just, you know, following the flow of the market as far as borrowing money, buying houses at the market price at the time. You know, they were caught up in events that they had little or no control over. In many cases, if you take a look at what's happened to the value of their property, where they bought. You know, values have declined because of the declining economic base within those areas. So, you know, it's about time someone stepped up and offered a bailout opportunity for some of them. It's in the name of justice here. It's about time.
This is Lester.
That's right.
Very, very rarely do we see, particularly in the modern period, political officials even come close to breaking the law, and it's not clear that this is, but even coming close to breaking the law on behalf of regular folk. So I'm going to give you – so let's look at Occupy Wall Street a couple of years ago. It's clear now, looking back, that mayors had a series of discussions that caused them – to, in some cases, engage in activity that's of questionable legality in evicting people involved in Occupy. Rahm Emanuel, when he was mayor of Chicago, when they had a big international summit come, and Mayor Emanuel decided to enforce a series of laws of questionable legality. Reducing people's ability to exert free speech. Those type of things happen far more often than we'd like, and they're relatively normal, right? But something like this, where an official decides to do something of questionable legality on behalf of social justice, happens very rarely. So that's something that should be applauded. But it's also something that, if it takes hold, could radically reshape reshape what we even think of as being possible in this political moment.
Jeff?
Yes, that's good. But I think it's also important to look at what cities, what any authorities do that's illegal, and that happens quite often and often usually in the favor of the wealthy,
right.
But also what they do that's legal, because the laws are designed created and approved by people who represent a certain class, not who represent everyone. So there are interesting examples of both of these issues. Legal activities of the Harbor Point TIF, you know, probably it's perfectly legal, but it's a theft from the people of the city of Baltimore. And then, of course, yes, there are the illegal activities. Apparently, Mayor Rawlings Blake did conspire with mayors across the country, with the Department of Justice, and with others to, in a concerted way, destroy the Occupy encampments.
So, folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. I mean, what, and your thoughts. Well, what does this mean for the future of our cities? Look at what's going on in Detroit. The bankruptcy in Detroit, the loss of pensions for municipal workers, many of whom do not have Social Security at all. All they have is their pensions. That could be gone. The banks could keep most of their money. Pensioners lose. People talk about equity here. And then we look at our own city. We talk about, and one of the things that Steve Isberg said to me this morning I wasn't even aware of, when you told me this morning that when you look at the park being built around Harbor Point, the money, what did you say, the money being spent there is greater than...
Oh, the money just for the development of the 6-acre park, the money they're allocating for that exceeds the entire park budget for the city, the entire budget.
So, and those are parks that the average citizen of Baltimore will not be able to use, despite what we hear at City Council from the developer. Because poor and homeless folks and African-American folks get a real hard time when they go down to the Inner Harbor, for example, which is a public park. In fact, my clients get arrested when they go down to the Inner Harbor. Young Black youth can't go to the Inner Harbor because they get harassed and arrested. There's a whole workforce commission on that issue. And I know people in Harbor East are now getting ticketed. Homeless folks are getting ticketed for just sitting on a bench in Harbor East. And I know they're not going to be allowed to go to Harbor Point Park.
And as we talk about, we'll talk about in the next hour, Mr. Patarakis has decided not to allow, if there is a rapid transit system going through downtown, will not allow a stop at East Harbor because there's one, quote unquote, that element here. Was the quote. So going back to the major point. So what does this mean about the future of our cities and where we are? I mean, this is a stark reality facing America. I think that because we're all so separated in our little silos, whether it's Baltimore, Detroit, Richmond, or wherever that is, you know, we become very myopic in our view sometimes of where we are. But this is a massive issue facing this country.
One of the things that concerns me the most about this issue, Mark, is the future of public employee pensions in general. If you take a look at what's going on in Detroit, the centerpiece of the dispute right now is whether or not the pension fund is overfunded or underfunded. On the one side, you have the city manager Orr. Mr. Orr is arguing that the pension is significantly underfunded and therefore a significant part of the liability, and he's trying to use that as justification to take over the pension fund if it goes into the bankruptcy pot and they successfully get into a bankruptcy proceeding. There's a good chance that that money will go to secured creditors as opposed to pension owners. The basis for Mr. Orr's claim that the fund is underfunded is a very low level assumption about the return on the investments that that pension fund would earn. The pension manager, on the other hand, is saying that that's not the case. The return that we can expect to earn is a lot higher. Therefore, the pension is not underfunded. It's overfunded or adequately funded. There is an ugly history here in the private sector, where back in the 1980s, overfunded pension plans were used by corporate takeover groups to finance leveraged buyouts. There was a question as to who owned the overfunded balances. And the hostile takeover groups went in, took the companies, terminated those pension plans, used the overfunded balances to pay either dividends or debt. And as a result, a lot of the employees lost their defined benefit pension plans. If what we see in Detroit is allowed to happen, you know, it calls into question the status of every pension plan in every city that's having financial trouble. And what might happen?
But we're seeing it everywhere. We talked before the show, and we'll come back. We're going to go to break here. We come with that pensioners have lost, people have lost their pensions even in the private sector. You know, we've seen what happened to people in Bethlehem Steel. men in their 70s, 80s, and 90s, all who worked all those years, many who fought in World War II and Korea, some who fought in Vietnam, who came back to work in those mills, have all lost their pensions and their health benefits, and that is allowed. So the question I have, and I'm going to throw it out here. Listen, I really want you to join us at 410-319-8888 with your solutions and ideas about what to do. And I'll pose the larger question we did the last time we had some of the same people on this panel. Can our economic system, known as capitalism, answer the questions any longer that faces this country? Can this system of corporate capitalism answer the questions, or is it just too powerful in terms of manipulating policy and power, that it has to be confronted? Is that part of it? What do you think? 410-319-8888. We'll back to you and our listeners and our guests in just a minute. Count Basie, I was thinking about Count Basie and the conflict we're talking about here in the air. It doesn't quite match. Maybe we need a little Count Basie. 410-319-8888 is the number here. We're here with Dr. Steve Isberg, Associate Professor of Finance at the University of Baltimore, Merrick School of Business, Jeff Singer, Founder and Former Executive Director of Healthcare for the Homeless, Dr. Lester Spence, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University, Center for Emerging Media Scholar and Residence, Detroit native, 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. What are your answers to these solutions? What do you think we need to do as a people to respond to this? And the question is, as I said earlier, is the structure that we have today in place, can it no longer answer the question? We went from the 1930s to the 1970s, pretty much, maybe slightly a little bit into the 80s, where you had where people thought the economy was booming and things were rolling and the middle class was growing and segregation ended and people were joining the middle class and all this stuff was going on, and everything seems to be rolled back. So can we no longer, given the system we have, answer the questions? Is the capitalist system just incapable of doing that?
Well, I think it is, but and we'll get into that discussion. I would like to point out that during that golden era of the 30s to the 70s, the tax rates were much, much higher. They were 92% in 1951 to 52. They were 50% until 1986. For the first 6 years of the Reagan administration, the top income tax rate was 50%. And then the Budget Control Act of 1986 reduced it. And it's now 39.6%, I think, this year. Our taxes are so much lower than any other advanced industrial country. Among the OECD countries, for example, 33 of them. There are only three that have lower income tax rates than we do. Or actually, not income tax, total tax rates. We're at about 27% of GDP. The average for OECD countries is 36%. Only Mexico and Turkey are below us. So one of the reasons we're in this fix, our cities can't afford to finance basic services. The Cherry Hill Recreation Center has no services for young girls. They can't afford them.
But we can afford to build a new park in Harbor Point.
Yeah.
I don't see
over a cadmium dump.
I don't see, you know, I see the tax issue is important, but I don't know if I'd describe our current system anymore as corporate capitalism. I think we're actually rapidly approaching corporate socialism or state capitalism. I think we've gotten far, far away from what would constitute a free market capitalist type of structure. And I think that's unfortunate, because I think in a free market capitalist structure, I think individuals have greater opportunity than we have today. I don't expect that you would see the kind of legally sanctioned consolidation and monopoly building that we have, particularly in the financial industry, take place in a less fettered capitalist system. You know, I think it's because of the degree of government involvement in that capitalist system that we've got a lot of the problems that we have. And, you know, we could have a long conversation about what would happen if we change that system and what tax rates would be appropriate. I don't necessarily dispute the fact that we have a tax revenue problem. The real interesting question lies in, you know, where does the burden of paying those taxes fall? Who's paying them? And, you know, how's that shifting over time? Those are some interesting questions. But I really think that, you know, if we were to return to a system that would be more purely free market, I think there would be a lot more solutions available to us than we have now.
Lester?
Yeah, I'm trying to see what – I'm thinking in my head, you know, what that would – what actually a free market system would look like. I mean, the challenge is that every point in time you've got – government that has to kind of create that market, right? And consistently, when we rely on government to, I mean, when we talk about that free market and that free market ends up being constructed, right? The corporate actors tend to get more, and people with more resources tend to game that system. So what's interesting to me to bring back in an interesting way, not so much Count Basie, but the example of jazz, is I think that what we have, I've got a really interesting book on my shelf called The Fierce Urgency of Now, which looks at improvisation as a core component of politics. And if we think about jazz, that's, you know, what we tend to think about. What we're seeing with these cities is an attempt by activists, by regular folk, and by political officials to innovatively improvise our way towards a more left-leaning society. And I think that a society that has a society that politically – a society with public policies that tend to be liberal and even further to the left tends to create more opportunities for people to live their lives, right, to live full, healthy full, healthy, worthwhile lives. So to answer your question, I mean, no, capitalism has never really been the answer. And in this current moment, it seems to generate consistent crises. But what we have in the case of Richmond in particular, and perhaps in Detroit, we don't know what's coming down there, but is a pushback, is a really progressive pushback against that.
So, and when you look at places like Baltimore right here, one of the things that, I mean, and the absurdity of some of the situations, and we know that the very shortly that this there'll be a done deal at Harbor Point. It's going to happen. And one of the things that we talked about before the air, just to get some of the absurdity of what's going on here and get your thoughts on this, folks, but get these calls coming in, is that before the air, you read me an email, Steve Isberg, about a friend of yours, a colleague at the University of Baltimore where you teach, who wrote about the park that being built, right? You can paraphrase. It was
okay. Well, I'll read it. Would you take your toddler to play in a first-rate public park that nonetheless was built on top of a chromium factory site? And by the way, that site was punctured by pilings for a high-rise only a few yards away from the swings and the sandboxes. My answer? No, I would not.
No. So, but that's part of the absurdity. When this is a toxic dump site that we know we're building on, they're going to build on. They've already said in one of the reports, EPA, that the danger would be if you puncture the cap. If you puncture the cap.
The slurry cap,
which could invariably happen when you're building on a site and have to put pilings in, that the company that owned it before, Ally Chemical, now Honeywell, has a $100 million indemnity on the property in case they're sued because the cap is hit. So they clearly are worried that the cap could be hit, or they wouldn't worry about having indemnity from it, but no one's talking about it. As you said, when it got to city council, Jeff Singer, the city council would not even talk about it when it was raised.
Yes, yes, sad but true. All of the environmental issues around Harbor Point have been pushed to the side. After all, it's on the harbor. The National Science Foundation just announced that the oceans are going to rise 3 feet in the next century. Harbor Point's going to be underwater. But no one wants to talk about that because there's money to be made there.
So we'll just have a nice swimming pool on the ground floor.
But So let me open the phones here. Like, the question is that when I ask a very serious question about whether or not the system we have now can answer the questions, if everything is motivated by purely by not just profit but by the power relationships between those who can own the capital and those who manage our city governments, which is where most decisions are made, as I've said to someone in the past, I said, no, I don't think it's a conspiracy. I think it's the world you run in. That's who you speak to. That's who you talk to. That's who you make deals with. Leaves the rest of us out. 410-319-8888. Grace, you're on the air.
I'm calling because in the 90s, I bought a house for $89,900, and I borrowed some money in the house in 2000 to have some remodeling. Now my house is over $200,000 I owe, and the house in the neighborhood, is the value is lower. The house is cost more than what it's worth now.
Right.
And I would like to know if there's any possible way that I can find out who do I get to find, you know, to get my house in a lower rate, in a lower payment, because the house is not worth what I am paying. They have charged me so interest. And I don't know if it's because of my credit wasn't that great. I don't know. So, but the house in the neighborhood is selling for lower now, like a house just sold for $170,000.
Mm-hmm.
It just sold just about 3 months ago for $170,000. But before, the house is in the neighborhood, in the 2000, they was running like $250,000. Now the house has gone down. They've gone down now, a house sold for $170,000. So now I owe over $250,000, and I bought the house in the 90s.
For 89.
And I owe more than what the house has cost.
So this is the great American dilemma. I don't that there are it's very difficult to renegotiate these loans with banks. There were some programs that people like Elijah Cummings and others were pushing through Congress to allow people to ameliorate some of those loans. But I don't know how active those are at the moment.
Grace, are you having difficulty paying the loan right now, or are you current on the payments?
Grace, you're still there?
Yes, I'm here.
Are you still current on your payments? Are you having difficulty paying your loan?
Yeah, I'm current on the payment. It's just that it's killing me, you know, making the payment.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You know, it's just that I'm on a fixed income, and it's taking all my money to pay this mortgage,
mm-hmm.
and and I'm paying more than what it's worth. You know, paying more money, paying the mortgage, and the house don't work that much no more because the value of the house is going down.
Mm-hmm.
See, so I want to know where is it possible? You know that they said something modification. I tried modification, and I got into it, but it's still high. I'm still
right.
paying a high mortgage payment.
So I think that what Grace is saying is what we're talking about, what happened in Richmond, California, which is where which is why the mayor and city council of Richmond stepped in and said, we're going to go back to the market value of the house and everything is going to be gone. But that people like Grace, a lot of us have houses underwater.
I mean, 12.5 million of us have houses underwater, according to RealtyTrack.
Right.
Yeah. And there are houses underwater. Grace, unfortunately, your problem isn't unique to your neighborhood. You can go out in Western Howard County and find people who are in a similar situation to you because they bought at one price, saw the value of their houses go up, borrowed against that value, put money back into their houses, did whatever they needed to do with that money, and you know they're stuck paying on a house that is worth less than they owe. The reality of the situation is if you can manage to pay that mortgage down and pay it off, eventually you will have an asset that still has some value. And you can avoid a foreclosure, and you know eventually you may be able to sell that house for a profit, or you know live in it for an extended period of time. You can always go to a lender and see if you can renegotiate a contract. But you know if you're current on your payments and you know not in a foreclosure situation, it's very doubtful that you're going to get much out of them.
Grace, I appreciate the call. I'm sorry going through what you're going through, and I know it's a very tough thing to go through. Which is one of the reasons I think that people have to kind of find a different response to what's facing us and not accept what's given us. 410-319-8888. Vivian, you're on the air.
I just want to make a comment.
Sure.
About the pals that be. And the situation in Baltimore City, talking about the land that is, well, I'll say diseased, because that's what it is, that they're building upon. And I always have a statement about the school system and the money, the lotteries that the lotteries that are supposed to aid the school system itself. And my comment is that power and greed has no conscience, and that's what I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Vivian, so much. Before we go to our next caller, let me come back to our panel here. I mean, I really want to go back to where the sense of our callers were saying, and I'm curious what would you all posit to be the steps that have to be taken? I mean, you see whether it's Richmond is now has to face the major banks, Deutsche Bank and other major banks, and the Federal Reserve, which was put in place, as we talked about before, in the early 1900s to manage banks. Of course, now it's being managed by the banks. So it doesn't manage anything. And you see what's happening there, what's happening here in Harbor Point, what happened in Detroit. So what is the response? That's why I asked the question. Is the system we have now incapable of answering the question? What does that mean?
Let me jump in. You've asked that question a number of times. I want to push you on that. I actually argue that's not really the question we should be asking.
All right, go ahead.
The question we should be asking is where do we see resistance? What does that resistance look like? And how did it happen? Right. Looking specifically at Baltimore, where we live now, where can we see resistance? We see some pushback in the Harbor Point issue. One city councilman was actually removed from chairing a committee because he believed strongly that the Harbor Point, that the corporate boondoggle was wrong. Right. And there are other city council persons who feel the same way. That's one way we can see pushback, and one thing we can do as citizens is support that. What Richmond is doing, though, is another thing. And then what Jackson, Mississippi is doing, where they elected a card-carrying black revolutionary nationalist, is yet another thing. So there are examples all over. It's about identifying. So in the case of Baltimore, Jessica Lewis and a number of people have been working, have been trying to engage in radical politics against foreclosure, against absentee landlordism. I mean, so that's one project that's worth analyzing, and there are others.
I accept that response, Lester. I think that's one of the responses I'm looking for, to see what people think.
Well, there's an interesting connection to your This Day in History. You talked about Emma Goldman and what Emma Goldman went out and encouraged people to do. And what Emma Goldman was doing back in the at the turn of the 20th century was creating a counterweight to a large consolidated group of employers who were, you know, exploiting the labor market because the labor market was disorganized. And, you know, if you take a look at our current state of what I'll call, again, corporate socialism, we've gotten to the point where, you know, particularly since 2008 with the latest crisis, the financial industry has been allowed to consolidate. You know, we have a lot fewer banks right now than we did in 2008, but it's not because we don't have major money setter banks. It's because we have fewer community banks that were out there making loans at the community level. They were shut down and their assets were all given to the bigger banks. And, you know, that consolidated group now, you're dealing with a smaller number of very well-endowed financially and very well-endowed politically parties to the system. And what I see the Richmond government doing is you know, standing on behalf of its citizens and saying, look, my individual citizens can't stand against you guys. But, you know, we as a city can now take a stand. And, you know, you're creating a counterweight.
I'm curious. The terminology is interesting. Corporate socialism. I probably wouldn't put those two words together, but I understand what you're trying to say. But go ahead.
Yes, I wanted to talk a little bit about inequality, and then get back to Dr. Spence's point with respect to the banks. Our city is so unequal. You know, the average household income in Roland Park is $112,000 a year. The average household income in Upton is $13,000 a year. And guess what? There are three banks on one block in Roland Park, right? Right on Roland Avenue. There are no banks in Upton. There are no banks in Sandtown, Winchester. Now, in part, there are no banks because there's no wealth in those communities. But to a large measure, there's no wealth in those communities because of a long history of racism and real public policies that have segregated the city, that have denied employment and wealth to African Americans. These things are not accidental, and they're not just from the market. Now, back to the point of resistance. Yes, my gosh, there's resistance all over the place now in the United States. You have a radio show about it these days, which is really exciting.
Every Friday.
Yeah, that's really exciting. Rose can't solve her problem by herself. She can solve her problem if she gets together with other people and continues to organize and mobilize. There's a Fair Development Coalition in Baltimore that we work with that's part of the movement against not just Harbor Point, but the constant giveaways. A billion dollars has been given away to private corporations just in Harbor East and Harbor Point. $1 billion public dollars. And what does the rest of the city see from this? We see closed fire stations. We see closed rec stations. And half of the kids in Baltimore City who are entitled to free lunches and breakfast at schools in the summer, half of them don't get fed because there isn't enough money to do it. Now, is there enough money in America to do it? Yes, absolutely.
Let me go back to the phone, see where our listeners are before the end of the show at 410-319-8888. We'll get to Eugene and Bruce, I think, for the top of the hour. Eugene, you're on the air.
Hi,
Eugene.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was calling because I'm a doctor, and I lived 10 years actually in Spain, and I was trained in Spain, and I work and live now in Baltimore. And I was really, my eyes were open at the time I lived in Spain. I think I went there with an American arrogance and an attitude, and I was really surprised by how highly they're taxed, so much higher than we are, 21% sales tax. I lost 60% of my income as a doctor working there in Texas. But I realized that people live so much better lives than we did, and especially the poor people. And I think, you know, when I came back here, just mainly because it's my family, I just realized how really messed up capitalism is, especially for the poor people here in this country. And I so wish a lot of times that people could go experience what I experienced so they could realize kind of the lies that I feel like we're taught about, you know, what socialism is about and who it really benefits, and the benefits that I feel like the poor people don't have, you know, not having access to mainly the health care and education. You know, they have free health care, an excellent health care system in Spain, and I realize how much it really impacts people's lives, not having that security of what if I get sick, you know, who's going to take care of me. And I just wanted to share that.
Eugene, I appreciate the call. I think it's a very important call to a statement for you to make for us, because that is what we don't understand. I mean, I think that you can ameliorate poverty to points where people can actually survive and grow. The country that has the least chance of people growing themselves out of poverty into a middle class, upper class life is now the United States of America, not England with its class system, not France, not Spain, not Italy, the United States of America. So, and that's reality.
Yeah, the only caveat I'd have to say about your point, Eugene, is that, you know, it may look good now. If you take a look at what's happening in the euro economy, it's really not growing. You've got mountains and mountains of debt crises on the horizon. And, you know, the real question is what you see in Spain sustainable in the long term? Will that system be able to sustain itself? Will it generate enough income to generate enough tax revenue to provide the services and still be able to pay off the debt that it's accumulated without having to expand its currency in such a way that it'll just gut everybody's accumulated wealth and drive everybody into poverty? I mean, that's a significant question.
And then that, again, calls into question the notion of capitalism, I think.
Yeah, well, another solution is just to cancel the debt. Argentina canceled their debt, and now they've grown, and the country's much stronger. And we could do that all over the world. Germany, in the 50s, had much of their debt canceled, and we know what's happened to the German economy. It's the strongest one in Europe.
Now, remember, when you cancel debt, you redistribute income and wealth, wealth, and the question is, what's the fair way to do that? So is there a fair way
maybe not
to reallocate the wealth by canceling debt? We can have that discussion.
We should pick up on that discussion. Lester, a thought before we have to maybe try to get one more caller in here and call it a day.
I'm just consistently, and again, that's why we're doing this Detroit-Baltimore
Oakland series.
I'm consistently impressed by the ability of local folk to change their condition, even in the face of what seems to be daunting odds. And what's happening in Richmond really encourages me.
Can we have time for another quick call? One quick call? Bruce, a final thought from you before we leave. Bruce, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing? I'm
good.
Trying to make it real quick. So I heard, hello?
You're there, Bruce. Go ahead.
Yeah, so the Harbor Point, so everybody's blaming the city council people that vote against. I agree. And blaming the developers. I agree. They're wrong. Well, you know who's driving that policy? The mayor. When it comes time to vote for her next time, don't vote for her. She's also driving the investment of Grand Prix. That's going to be for the third time. Is it going to meet the projections, and is a failure too. She's driving that. Don't vote for the mayor. She's always talking jobs. She's going to need to look for a job when it comes up time for election.
Bruce, thanks so much for your call. We have time for one more quick thought from a listener. Yes? Let's take a final thought from Ed. You're on the air. We have like a minute and a half, Ed.
Yeah, I'm just piggybacking on what the gentleman just said. The capitalistic ways that we have right now are getting to be deploring. And if we keep going the way we're going, it's now becoming a have and have not state. I've talked to people in other countries. I'm not saying that socialism is the best way to go, but it seems as though everybody's happy. And if we don't figure this stuff out, we're going to have our own uprising. That's all I have to say.
Ed, and you've had the last voice for today's show, I guess. Or do you have the last voice, Jeff?
If you don't mind, September 16th.
Oh, yes, right.
Enoch Pratt Library. There'll be a forum on affordable housing. Congressman Elijah Cummings will be there. Paul Graziano, our housing commissioner.
You'll be there.
I'll be there. The Homeless Persons Representation Project is sponsoring this, and I'd like to see many of your listeners there.
Please come. We're going to be taping the whole thing to make it part of our documentary series on housing. We're going to tape what goes on there so we can use it for the airwaves and more. So we'll all be there, too, as well for that day. Jeff Singer, founder and executive director of Healthcare for the Homeless, Dr. Lester Spence, associate professor of political science and Africana studies at Johns Hopkins, and Dr. Steve Isberg, associate professor of finance at the University of Baltimore Merrick School of Business. Thank the three of you so much.
Always a pleasure, Mark, always.
And thank you all. It's great to have all of you. It was a good conversation. And thanks to all of our listeners for calling in with your really interesting ideas. We'll come back and look at the Red Line, trolleys, the future transportation in our city. Stay with us.